Progressive Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, Dr. Diana Wiley. And Dr. Charlie Glickman is back. On June the 18th, we spoke about somatic sex coaching. Fascinating interview, archived, of course. Some of you know how to access it through my website, drdianawiley.com. But, of course, you can go through the PRN website as well. Dr. Charlie Glickman is a sex and relationship coach. He's an educator. As we mentioned, somatic sex coaching and body worker. And anyway, Charlie does it. Really good work, and does a lot of really good work, and I'm so glad you're back. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Diana. It's a pleasure to be back on the show.
Now, I'm not hearing you very well, but maybe it's just my phone. Can you get a little closer to your speaker, or maybe, I don't know what.
Yeah, I've got my mic right up in front of me.
Okay, that's a little better. Okay. So... today, Charlie and I wanted to talk about common concerns that come with that many of his clients present with, and I think we're going to mainly focus on a couple of them. But if there's time, we'll look at more. But checking out during sex is one common concern, and receiving sensual touch, and of course, there are overlaps between those two things a lot. So. Wouldn't you agree, Charlie, Dr. Charlie?
I definitely do. There are quite a few questions or concerns that show up in people's sex lives and relationships that sometimes come from similar root causes, even if they express themselves very differently.
Charlie, you're still kind of quiet. Maybe the producer can cut in and tell me that it's okay on the New York end of things, if he can hear you all right. Maybe it's my own hearing, but I don't think so, because usually I hear things well. Anyway, we'll just continue and make sure you're projecting, Dr. Charlie, because you have important things to say.
Is it any better?
Well, say a little more.
Okay, I'm not sure if this is any better today.
All right, well, we'll go on and just see how it goes.
Okay, I'll try to talk loud, although I'm holding the phone right next to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so the checking out during sex prevents letting go during sex, which is really, really important, letting go. And I've got four things that help a lot of people let go, but why don't you introduce how it goes first, how it goes with your clients, and what about their checking out during sex? What are some of the reasons?
Sure. Well, so I think I want to start just by explaining what I mean when I use the term checking out, because people use that to mean a few different things.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm talking about it, I'm mostly referring to when people aren't feeling fully present in their bodies. Maybe they're getting distracted. Maybe they're thinking about something else, like, oh, I need to paint the ceiling, or, oh, I better remember to pick up the groceries tomorrow. You're not fully engaged and present in the experience. It's sort of like the phenomenon of, watching TV and, flipping through Facebook or Instagram on your phone at the same time. You're not really doing either of those things with all of your attention. But I think it's also important to remember that sometimes checking out is the result of past experiences of painful sex or sexual trauma or challenges in the relationship. If you're feeling resentment towards your partner, you know, you might find yourself checking out during sex because you're trying to grit your teeth and get through it.
Right.
But one of the ways that you can tell when you're checking out is that it doesn't really feel like you're fully there. You know, you're distracting yourself, you're focusing on something other than what you and your partner are doing. Maybe you keep bringing up other things, like you'll be in the middle of having sex and suddenly you'll say something like, "Oh yeah, I forgot to tell you, I got the oil changed on the car today." You know, those are all signs that you might be checking out during the experience.
Yeah, distractions come in very handy if you don't really want to be there. But I think it's important to realize that things don't distract us. We distract ourselves. And we've got all of these. And, of course, the most difficult person going through this is often one who's had trauma, exploitation, mistreatment that they've suffered around sexuality. And you've touched on this already.
And especially if that has happened with their partner. You know, because sometimes our partners have crossed our own boundaries, whether they did it knowingly or not, or, you know, maybe we're still upset because of the fight that happened yesterday, but now, you know, your partner wants to have makeup sex and your body isn't really ready for that.
Your body isn't ready for it. You're not motivated. It may be that some of your nerves even aren't in the right place. Especially for a woman, I would say, more than men, but I'd like to check this out with you, that women's desire is responsive rather than spontaneous. So she needs to really be there in her mind as well as her body.
Yeah, I think that is true to a degree. I've certainly talked with men who have a responsive pattern or women who have a spontaneous pattern, but it does seem to be pretty true that, you know, folks who have a responsive pattern, if you are checking out during sex, then there's a lot less likelihood that you're going to get the kind of stimulation that you need because you need to be able to respond to your partner. Having said that, I have certainly talked to people who have spontaneous patterns, and for them, checking out might include increasing the intensity of the stimulation. So, you know, maybe I have a spontaneous pattern, but I'm not really into having sex with my partner in this particular moment or this experience. And so I'll amp it up by, you know, like the more intense, like hard pounding intercourse or like really intense dirty talk, or maybe even using alcohol or other drugs as a way of like overcoming that hesitation. So there are definitely ways that people with spontaneous patterns can check out, but it does frequently look a little bit different.
Yes, yes. If a woman can't stop thinking about household chores or feels unattractive, I think we need to talk about body image, or can't stand her partner's breath.
Yeah.
Those feelings, maybe not so much in these cases her biology, but these feelings may be the basis of her lack of desire.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that sexual medical practitioners, you know, particularly medical doctors, sometimes forget that what looks like a libido issue or an arousal issue might actually be a relational issue.
Yes.
You know, if somebody has multiple sexual partners, that can be a little easier to tease out because they might be able to say, oh, yeah, this is an issue with partner A, but not partner B.
Yes.
But if you only have one partner, it's hard to differentiate between those two things.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I tend to see clients with one partner. Some of the women are wishing that they could not have a monogamous relationship anymore, and then we have to talk about that. The women, and we're finding more and more, there's a book called Untrue by Wednesday Martin. It's fascinating, and the book is all about female sexual desire and how it's rather robust. And a lot of women have trouble with monogamy. And the culture that we've lived in for so long influences that. But a lot of women do have trouble with this.
Yeah, well, and the thing that...
And they get bored.
In that. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And one of the things that's important in that is that when we're talking about non-monogamous relationships, that can be everything from, you know, my partner and I occasionally have a threesome with somebody else, mm-hmm. to a full-on, yeah, I have this, you know, boyfriend over here and this girlfriend over there and these other people who I see when I'm in town on business. So there's this whole range of ways that people can have more than one partner. And one of the blessings and one of the challenges of non-monogamy is figuring out what pattern is going to work for you, because people are different.
And in your work, you will help your client with that sort of thing if that's on her or his agenda.
Yeah, I definitely do. And part of it is figuring out what they think they might want, and then finding ways to experiment and explore, and then, you know, once they've had that experience, how do you integrate what you've learned back into your sex life? So it's actually not too different from, you know, the way science works, right? You have an experiment, you find out what the results are, and then you use that to design your next experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I touched on body image, but I'd like to circle back to that because I don't think I've had a male client be so worried about body image, but I do have plenty of female clients, and I think in terms of letting go, it's important to let go of how your body used to be. You know, none of us are getting any younger, and I know for a fact that I have parts that used to be firmer, higher, smaller, and they aren't now. And so I've accepted that, and my husband, my lover, accepts it too. And I think that the energy that some people, some women especially, put into sucking in their stomachs, holding your butt, pretending you don't look exactly the way you do, is energy taken away from good sex that you could be having.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely true. You know, you can't relax if you're trying to hold in your gut. And relaxation is the foundation of your erotic response. And part of why I say that, you know, on sort of a macro level, right? If you're so busy holding yourself rigid, you know, you're not going to be as open to the sexual sensations and the interactions. But also, you know, sexuality or sexual response on a neurological level requires both excitement and relaxation. You need to have the balance of the two. And the more relaxed you are, ironically, the more room there is for the excitement. The relaxation is sort of the foundation for the sexual experience. And so when I'm working with folks around these kinds of concerns, you know, body image I think you're right, Diana. Body image is one of those that it has a lot more to do with how we perceive ourselves than how other
yes.
people perceive us. And, you know, we do know that as a general rule, you know, women do tend to be far more critical of their own bodies than their partners are, whether their partners are male or female. That's not to say that there aren't partners who bring in some of those body shaming messages, because there certainly are. But, you know, as a general rule. And one of the things that I find so interesting about it, if we're talking about heterosexual couples in particular, is how often women will say to me, oh, well, you know, I need to get my hair done and I need to get my eyebrows done and all of these different things. And then they turn around and complain that their boyfriends or husbands don't even notice. And so there's this weird mixture of, I'm sure he notices everything. Oh, wait, he's not actually noticing any of that.
He's not actually noticing what?
He's not
any
actually
of that?
Noticing any of it, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if he doesn't notice when you get a new hairstyle or when your nails are a different color or when you're wearing new lingerie, is he really likely to notice if you gain a few pounds?
Probably not, but women have trouble believing that.
Exactly.
You know, most men are just so happy to have you there naked and interested.
Yeah.
They're not
yeah.
thinking about your possible chubby thighs or your possible drooping breasts. They're not thinking about it.
They're yeah, not nearly as often as women do.
I say that again.
Not nearly as often as women often do.
Yes, and a study was done a long time ago that showed that women thought that their men thought that they should be actually 5 pounds less than they were. And when they interviewed the men didn't think so in this particular study. It was a small study. But
yeah.
So our self-image often collides with what our lover is thinking. And I think this ties into another problem that about letting go, and that is that there are some women that worry about what a partner will think of you later, you know, not really realizing that we all look silly at times during sex if we're really enjoying ourselves, and if we and our partner are fortunate and will during sex perhaps squeal and beg and perhaps even fart and suck and demand and drool and lose track of time, space. And so I think decide before you begin that that is okay. And even talk about that. You know, we're back to good communication with your partner. Talk about it, or don't bother taking off your clothes if...
Yeah, I think good communication, and also we're talking about bringing a level of play into it. You know, when you watch people playing, whether it's children or adults, if they're genuinely having fun, you know, they're not worried about what their faces are doing. If you see somebody who's having a great time on the ski slopes, you know, and they've got a big grin on their face, and, you know, they don't really care in that moment, you know, that somebody else might look at them and think they look goofy, that they're having too much fun. And I think that it's unfortunate that for a lot of people as adults that we lose our capacity for fun. And that has a big impact on our sex lives in ways that I don't think many people really pay much attention to.
Can you expand on that point a bit?
Sure. Well, I think some of it is that you know, we're still influenced by that Puritan cultural tradition that says, you know, you're not allowed to have fun until you get all of your chores finished.
Yeah, and, the Puritan values. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the chores are never going to get finished. There's always laundry to do or, you know, a floor to sweep or dishes to put away or whatever it is. But I think a lot of it is that as we get, you know, as we become adults, you know, people keep telling us, well, it's time to grow up and buckle down and, you know, do this and that and the other thing. And there's truth to that, right? There is a time to transition into adulthood and take some of that on. But when we lose our capacity for playfulness, you know, sex becomes either very, very serious or it becomes kind of boring. You know, the whole notion of, yeah, let's try sex toys, let's try this, let's try that. You know, that's an element of playfulness that that I think is worth cultivating in your life generally. You know, I think it's worth asking yourself, when was the last time I did something just for fun? You know, when was the last time I went on a hike because I wanted to go on a hike?
Wait, I didn't quite hear that. I heard when was the last time I did something just for fun, and then I didn't hear the next part.
So, for example, when was the last time I went on a hike just because I wanted to be outside rather than because I wanted to burn some calories and lose weight?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when was the last time I went out dancing or to a concert or something, you know, just because I enjoy it? And when we start cultivating fun as something that we can do in our daily lives, that starts to have real positive impact on our sex lives. Because, you know, if you're serious 6.5 days out of the week, and then it's, you know, Saturday evening and you want to have sex with your partner, you're going to be out of practice for being playful.
Yes, it's unfortunate that, and in my experience, men get into this more than women, because if they have any sexual dysfunction, perhaps it's erectile dysfunction or premature ejaculation, they'll get into some performance anxiety, and then sex becomes, well, we have a job to do here, and there's no play and relaxation and laughing. I mean, ideally, and I know we're on the same page here, Charlie, ideally, sex is play. It's the highest order of play when it's done with toys or dressing up or not necessarily having to have sex have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And maybe it's not just intercourse. Maybe there's plenty of outer course. In fact, I think that's often essential for more playful sex, because it can take away. That's what the sensate focus exercises, of course, are about. It takes away from the pressure some men feel about actually penetrative sex.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, the focus that so many people have, men and women, have on erections being necessary for sex or being necessary for pleasure or any of those things, it becomes a chore. And I've talked with, I don't even know how many men, and I know you have too, Diana, you know, guys who are convinced that, oh, you know, if I'm not fully erect the entire time we're naked, then I'm a failure as a man. And the irony is that anxiety causes both erection difficulties and early ejaculation.
Mm-hmm.
And from a biological perspective, right? From a biological perspective, that actually makes sense, because, you know, if I'm walking through the woods and a bear suddenly starts chasing me and I'm in danger, that's mm-hmm. not the time to have an erection. That's the time to fight or flight.
That's right.
And the difficulty is that our bodies can't tell the difference between the adrenaline that happens because we're being chased by a bear and the adrenaline that happens because, you know, my boss dropped a project on my desk at, you know, 4:30 on a Friday.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And same thing, the reason why anxiety causes early ejaculation. I don't like calling it premature because we don't have good definition of how long sex is supposed to last.
Right.
But same thing, right? If I'm, you know, walking out in, if I'm an animal walking through the woods and there's an opportunity to mate, but I'm not sure that I'm 100% safe, you know, that bear might show up, I'm going to want to get it over with as quickly as possible so that I'm not in danger. So, you know, that's why I don't necessarily think of these things as sexual dysfunctions. Sometimes they are functional responses to dysfunctional situations.
That's true. You know, you're talking about wanting to get it over with as soon as possible. I have a very vivid memory of being in Africa with a former husband, and there was, we came upon these two lions mating. They mate all the time, but this one male lion had a really bloody nose, and so we watched them from our little vehicle, and he was done in about 60 seconds, and I guess the female wasn't so pleased because she turned around and whopped him on his nose with her paw. So he had a bleedy nose. He didn't look very happy. But I think that's the reason that they have often have rapid ejaculation, because they're in Africa and they might have some other, not so much the lion, but because they're kind of kings, right? But
right.
But still,
they're vulnerable when they're having sex.
Yes, they're more vulnerable when having sex, yes. And so receiving sensual touch is very hard. I saw a client earlier today, I'm going to call him Bob, and we've had several sessions, and he was sexually abused by an older brother. And so when he and his fiance do, and I'm mainly helping him with the sexual abuse and overcoming that, because he gets triggered, like when he and his fiance were doing the Sensate Focus homework, the touching, when they got up to week 3, which involves touching more than face, hands, as you know, face, hands, mm-hmm. and feet, get up to, and then there's more torso touching and genital touching, and perhaps intercourse, but he had to, you know, the person getting receiving the touch can say when they're uncomfortable to please stop, and he had to do that because he was triggered by the sexual abuse from his brother. So all those, it's a form of PTSD, all those memories came flooding back because the, now you can speak about this as a sexological body worker, but the body holds memories, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does. And we hold memories in our bodies in a lot of different ways and in a lot of different places. So, you know, for me, it's less of a question of, you know, oh, I'm feeling this in my back or in my chest. What does that mean? I always turn that around and I say, okay, so what does that mean for you? Because somebody else might hold something very different in the exact same place. I was talking about this with my housemate the other night because, for me, you know, I had been working out at the gym and my back was sore from it. And whenever that happens, I'm more likely to feel sadness. That's just, you know, a place in my body where I hold that. And my housemate was talking about how when they've been running and their legs are sore, their hamstrings are sore, that tends to make them feel anxious. And it was just interesting how we each hold very different feelings in different parts of our bodies, but fundamentally it's the same thing.
Yes, fundamentally it is the same thing, but when people have these kinds of intrusive thoughts, I think mindfulness can be a help. I've just started a book by Dr. Lori Brato, who's out of Vancouver, B.C., and she's, since 2002, she's been studying mindfulness, but now she's got it all in a great book. Mm-hmm. Not too far into it yet, but Better Sex Through Mindfulness, How Women Can Cultivate Desire. It's a book I do recommend, and there are some exercises. I haven't read through them, but I glanced at them. It's a good book, and mindfulness, as she describes it, it's the practice of non-judgmental awareness, and of course, it's rooted in Buddhism. And she teaches women concrete skills of body awareness, present moment focus, and then she helps them gradually apply those skills to sexual settings. It's interesting because she thinks, Dr. Brato thinks, her theory is that sexual response in women is related to the mind being in sync with the body. The idea is supported by studies that show that women who experience low desire or a disconnect between physical and subjective arousal. So becoming more aware of the body, noticing the body non-judgmentally, can be a way to really tune into arousal. Hasn't that been your experience with your clients?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's actually true for people of any gender, because,
yes,
you know, when you ask people, you know, they've done all of those studies where they measure people's genital blood flow while showing them, you know, erotic images, you know, porn on a video, and a lot of women report not feeling turned on even though there is a lot of vaginal blood flow. I actually think something similar could happen for men, except that when you get an erection, you can feel it inside your clothing. So, you know, I think that if there was a way to set that up so that you weren't getting the physical feedback from your clothing touching your erection, I think a lot of men would be challenged to tell how turned on they were. And, of course, genital blood flow and erections don't always match up with arousal anyway. But, circling back to what you were saying about mindfulness, I am a big fan of the growing body of work around mindfulness.
Yeah.
But when it comes to sex, it can also be a two-edged sword. I read a study once, or I'm sorry, not a study, an article about how all of these big corporations decided to institute mindfulness training for their employees because of all of the research showing that mindfulness boosts productivity. But it turns out that if you hate your job, mindfulness makes it harder for you to get work done because you're so focused on how bad your job makes you feel. And so productivity actually
goes down. That's very interesting.
Right? And I think the same thing happens or can happen in relationships. If you are happy in your relationship, then mindfulness will help you tune into that happiness and your arousal and your desire. But if you're feeling resentment towards your partner, or if you're feeling shame for your sexual desires, or if you have a history of sexual trauma that you haven't healed yet, mindfulness is going to bring all of that closer to the surface, in which case it actually becomes more difficult unless you address the root problem.
You know, that's true.
And
the outcome often is that bad sex leads to the expectation of more bad sex in the future.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult loop. In their minds, a lot of these people think it's somehow they're holding them back. And there's some interesting studies, you're probably aware of them, about rats. And rats are similar to humans and how our brains and so on, the rat brain, and mm-hmm. And this Jim Faust, have you heard of him? A psychologist and neurobiologist at Concordia University, and one of the most prominent torchbearers of the so-called vagina-brain connection. And so he has examined the way minute manipulation of neurochemistry affects the sexual behavior of rats. And in one study, he blocked female rats' ability to reap opioid rewards during copulation and found that even when their reward system was later unblocked, they rejected the mating effort, suggesting that bad sex leads to the expectation of more bad sex. And so it could be that female rats are teaching us something about female desire.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, and especially the idea of, you know, if I had an unpleasant experience, I'm going to expect that the next time. I mean, fundamentally, that's not really any different from, oh, you know, the last time I went to this restaurant, the food was overcooked, and so I'm just going to expect that this time. But it's fundamentally the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what all of this brings us back to is that these are all of these different reasons why people check out during sex. You know, we check out because of stress or anxiety or triggers or resentment or shame. You know, we check out because we are worried about our partner's responses or our partner getting triggered. You know, all of these things. And I do think that one of the challenges with all of this is that if you want to be more present and more attuned with your partner during sex, any of these difficulties, you know, you're going to need to address them. You can't just keep shoving them under the rug. It's a lot easier in the short term to just convince yourself, well, we'll buy a new vibrator, we'll try bondage, or whatever it is. But those are not going to resolve those deeper issues if that's what's really going on.
Yes. Just to shift slightly, and I totally agree with you, but there was in, let's see, 2014, at an FDA hearing, and I don't know what it was for. I'm going to guess it was for now it's pretty much being considered a failed female sexuality drug, Addy, although a new one came on the market. It's just the pharmaceutical companies are having a terrible time with these drugs for female desire because women are very complicated and they're with their brains. But here's what this woman, Alessandra Hirsch, said, and she is now a medical student, but she testified at the hearing, and she said, these are some things that have helped me with periods of low libido. And I'm going to quote the whole bit because it's good. My boyfriend, switching boyfriends, chocolate, coffee, certain episodes of Grey's Anatomy, pornography, upgrading my vibrator, the phrase a little to the left, the phrase not so hard, the phrase I love you, reading 50 Shades of Grey, a removable shower head, tips from my girlfriends, back rubs, back scratches, a good night's sleep, an absence of judgment from my boyfriend, an absence of judgment from my friends, a defiance of judgment from society, an acceptance of myself and the libido I came with, end quote.
Hmm.
I like her suggestions, and I think a lot of women could benefit from some of those suggestions. the removable shower head. Of course, lots of women are able to reach orgasm with focused water right on their clitoris, and I've known women that who don't have partners that make the end of their shower every morning end with an orgasm by focusing the spray on their clit. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and I, you know, because there are all of these different ways that, you know, all these different ways that people have sex or that thing, you know, different things that people enjoy, you know, I think it really does show the importance of being able to experiment and explore with these things. And you're coming back to what we were talking about with playfulness, right? It's a lot easier to be exploratory when you can be playful, right? Because playfulness is all about having fun, not about having a particular goal in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that makes
yes.
a big difference.
Yes. And in terms of the mindfulness, I came across another study. In this case, it was a sexual desire questionnaire. So women's scores on the sexual desire questionnaire improved 60% after 8 weekly mindfulness-based cognitive therapy sessions. And then we're back to Lori Brado here because she's been doing this with her clients for many years. And she says, we were surprised by the magnitude of the improvement with this program. Mindfulness improves mood and reduces stress, both of which affect desire and also teaches you how to pay attention to your body. So learning to be in the moment and ignore distractions can also help you really enjoy sex more. And pleasure fuels desire. That is so true. Having
it
fun,
really is.
Experiencing pleasure absolutely fuels desire. That's why when I ask couples, and they're a new couple, say I'll say, oh, let's see now. When was the last time you guys had any fun together? And they kind of look at me. No, there hasn't been much fun. It's, and consequently, their sex life tends to be boring and routine and not very playful.
Well, and I would be willing to bet that in most of those situations, there's probably a not a lot of fun happening outside the bedroom either. You know, what's keeping folks from putting on some fancy clothes and going out dancing or whatever it is, right? I think that we need to integrate more fun into our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh,
but,
absolutely,
but
dancing even is good for your sex life because it can help with the rhythms of dancing. Then later, when you're doing the horizontal dancing in bed, you can be perhaps more in rhythm with each other, more in sync.
Yeah.
More in sync.
Yeah, well, and more attuned to each other if you're doing partner dance because you're practicing that follow-lead dynamic. But I do want to circle back, though, to the question that we started with, which was checking out, because I realize there's one important thing here to say, which is that, you know, everybody tunes out or checks out sometimes. I mean, even if you're
yes.
if you're watching a movie and you're totally into it, there's still likely to be times when you get distracted, you know, maybe because the dog ran in front of the TV or you remembered something that you needed to do for work. So it's not inherently a bad thing. You know, the human
mm-hmm.
brain is not very well designed to stay focused on one thing all the time. But I think that it's this question of how often do you check out and how easily can you bring yourself back? And these are things that are practices. It's not something that you can just, you know, there's no magic bullet, you know, and you're done. But having said that, I just want to put it out there that while I know that it can be challenging for a partner if somebody checks out during sex. Partners sometimes can find that challenging or triggering or upsetting. But the more you pressure your partner or blame them or shame them or yell at them, the more you're actually going to fuel their checking out. Because, you know, why would I want to be present with you if you're going to yell at me?
Yeah, so, they have all these judgments.
Yeah, exactly. So
about me.
If you, you know, in the same way that, you know, teaching children or teaching children skills, right, it needs to be, hey, good job, good effort, and now here's how to do it better, right? It's more of the positive correction. I think it's the same thing in sexual relationships, right? Like, oh, yeah, I get that you got distracted just then. Understandable. You know, can you bring your attention back now? Rather than yelling or arguing, because that's just going to push them further away. And that's something that I work with a lot of my clients around, especially people who got yelled at a lot by their parents. Right, getting
yes.
yelled at by your partner then reminds you of being a kid, and that's just no fun for anybody ever.
Not ever. So I have a couple of very behavioral sort of exercises that have helped some of my female clients when they're distracted, when they're thinking about something else. So I get them to, and this requires practice, I get them to see a stop sign in their mind, stop, and come back to center, come back to the feelings. Now, sometimes that isn't so easy to do, but with practice, or see a conveyor belt slowly moving away from your mind, holding all the negative judgmental feelings, distracting feelings, moving away. Or borrowing from Zen meditation, quieting the monkey mind. The monkey mind, you know, imagine the little monkeys out there trying to distract you, making funny faces and jumping around. So quiet the monkey mind and come back to center with the mindfulness.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Well, and I like the idea of that imagery of the stop sign. I may experiment with that a little bit, because
yeah, it's a good, because we're all real familiar with it and we gotta stop.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, like, you know, whether you drive a car or not, you know, everybody can visualize a stop sign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that fits in here, because mindfulness meditation has shown promise as a treatment for depression. And, you know, I think that desire is a central nervous system mechanism shaped by sensitivity to rewards. So just as somebody with depression may experience a muted response to pleasure, spending time, there are a lot of pleasures for a lot of people, maybe spending time with friends, eating a fine meal, basking outside on a sunny day, and with low sexual desire, they may not respond to, say, a sensual touch from a loved one. And it may be that something going on in her life echoes throughout the nervous system, thus muting the response to rewards. So depression is a real factor in it. And then if the person is on an antidepressant, that often further lowers the libido.
Yeah, either lowers the libido or lowers the sexual response when there is arousal.
Lowers the libido or the sexual response, and I didn't hear the last part.
Oh, even when there is arousal, even when there's desire.
Oh, yeah.
Right, it's depending on the
Well,
medication.
They may have trouble reaching orgasm, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think this is a good place to circle back to something you were talking about earlier, with sensate focus or making sex about connection and intimacy rather than about erection or lubrication and orgasm. Because yeah. there is a way in which that opens up a lot more possibilities. And, you know, I've definitely worked with folks who live with depression, you know, to varying degrees. And one of the challenges that they often describe is feeling like, okay, so now my depression is making me a terrible lover, or it's making me an inadequate lover, or what have you. And for some of them, when they were able to make the shift away from orgasm and towards pleasure and connection, that opened up new avenues. You know, maybe it didn't change their body's responses because of the medication, or maybe it doesn't change their libido levels, but it creates opportunities for intimacy that are huge. And people often throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yes.
So I guess the other piece that I did want to say on the topic of checking out, there's one other big reason why people do, and that is when we endure touch or tolerate or endure touch that we don't actually want to receive. And stereotypically, this is something that, you know, we think of as women experiencing more than men because of gender dynamics and all of that. But I've certainly talked with plenty of men of all sexual orientations who tolerate unpleasant touch. And sometimes that kind of tolerating or enduring is because we don't know how to speak up, or we don't know what to ask for, or we expect that our partner is going to get upset with us. But the challenge or the difficulty is that as soon as you start to tolerate and then shift into enduring, your sexual arousal and libido are dropping and your resentment is building up. And so one of the skills that I frequently work on with my clients is to help them find their words and say something as soon as they notice they're tolerating. So for example, maybe it's that, you know, your partner is giving you a blowjob and they're using too much pressure or too much teeth, or it's too fast for you or too slow for you or whatever it is. As soon as you notice that you're tolerating it or enduring it, that's the time to speak up, because the longer you wait, the more upset you're going to be when you finally do say something.
It festers, and resentment can grow.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't speak up.
And there is nothing that kills a sex life faster than resentment.
Say that last part again.
Oh, sure.
I am having trouble hearing all of your words, and that's probably my fault. But anyway, say the last part again.
There is nothing that kills your sex life faster than resentment.
Yeah, kill your sex life.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, resentment is unexpressed anger, and you can't actually relax and be fully open and vulnerable and intimate with your partner if you're holding back your anger. Brené Brown makes the really interesting observation that you can't switch off just one emotion. You can't switch off just your anger or just your sadness or just your fear. Mm-hmm. If you turn one of them off, you turn all of them off, at least, or let me say that better. If you turn one of them off, you turn the others down, and that's going to get in the way of your sex life.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of work with people to help them step into that more empowered place of being able to speak up as soon as they realize they need to. It's a challenging skill, because there's a lot of reasons why people have difficulty with it, but when you overcome those hurdles, it has amazing benefits for your entire sex life. You know, that'll work much better than reading 27 books about the G-spot.
Yes, yes. I think, too, you can use all of these skills, and there's one more tip, and that is if you simply can't be in the present during sex, tell your partner. Maybe cuddle or talk for a while and then resume making love. Or not, but when you're cuddling or talking, just be very much in the present, and especially for the cuddling and hopefully kissing. I mean, I think kissing is an amazing it's amazing to kiss, and it's very intimate, and we can tell quite a lot about how our partner is feeling, and well, in new relationships, how the person kisses is quite revealing.
Yeah, it's actually it's one of those underrated skills, and I know you've had the experience, Diana, as a practitioner, of having clients talk about how they were really into somebody until they kissed them, and they were just a bad kisser, and everything, all the desire just sort of evaporated.
Yes.
So, yeah, kissing makes a big, big difference.
Yes, it absolutely. And most women that I've spoken to don't want the tongue going down the throat immediately. They want soft lips in the beginning and kind of warm up to deeper kisses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really makes it makes all the difference. It's that slow ramp up. And, you know,
right.
even though we stereotypically think of men as, like, wanting to just dive right in, because so many of us often do, you know, just a tip to the guys out there that your sexual experience will be much more fun if you can slow down. So you're doing it for yourself. Oh, there we go.
Charlie, that's the music. I'll be in touch with you. Thank you so much for this last hour. And we'll do it again soon. Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.